Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your door four times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you do, you can use the code KINGCAST at checkout to save a gigantic 25% off of your order. That is Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Red rum!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes death is better.
It's the KINGCAST, coming at you at the dawn of summer in 2026. I'm Anthony Bresnahan.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And we are your hosts, as always. Today, we welcome Mr. Sam Weller to the show. He is the two-time Bram Stoker Award winner. I know this for certain because he has the trophies behind him on the shelf right now.
he has two more, but he just to keep himself humble, he keeps those in the bathroom. So
they're suppositories.
He's a journalist, biographer, and fiction author. A huge part of his work is devoted to exploring the life and writing of Ray Bradbury. Few knew the legendary author of Fahrenheit 451 or Something Wicked This Way Comes better than Sam. Sam wrote The Bradbury Chronicles, The Life of Ray Bradbury, the follow-up book, Listen to the Echoes, The Ray Bradbury Interviews. Sam also co-edited the short fiction anthology Shadow Show, an array of stories sort of written in the style or in tribute to Ray Bradbury. Ray was a contributor to the book himself. You edited in 2015 The Last Interview, yeah. Ray Bradbury, who of course passed away in 2012 at the age of 91. In addition to Publishers Weekly, The Paris Review, ooh la la, NPR, Slate, and The Huffington Post, Sam writes for Pop Matters and the Los Angeles Review of Books. His short story collection is Dark Black, a compendium of eerie tales. They're very well worth your time. It starts with a bang. Little Spells, a story set in the Clutter murder house from In Cold Blood. There's a sea monster story that gives the book its title. And my favorite, Roadside Cross, about those creepy memorials you see on highways and back roads. Sam, yeah. Welcome to the KINGCAST.
Man, I gotta tell you, dude, that's the best introduction I've ever had over 20 years. Seriously, thank you, Anthony, and such a pleasure to be with you guys on such an awesome show with two people who are such, you guys are both talented in your own right in so many different ways, but you're also these, you know, experts in the world of Stephen King. So just what a great honor to spend some time with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you. We have that in common. We both keep the fires burning for a very popular author. Yeah,
right. That's important in post-literate America to keep the fires burning for a number of authors.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, before we dive into your work and your Stephen King stories and your favorite King, how did you get connected with Ray Bradbury? He was famously kind of open to people. Like you, I knew a lot of people who had his phone number and could just call him up. His advice was always the same: write a story every single day. Ray Bradbury and Stephen King to do, but right. Not so easy for the rest of us. How did you get connected with Ray?
Well, you know, I think the first time I met him, I told him this story, and I think it helped seal the deal with in terms of me eventually becoming his biographer. My dad was a veteran of the Korean War, and a lot of the veterans during the late era of World War II, read Weird Tales and a lot of the other pulp fiction magazines. And veterans during Korea read pulp magazines on the battlefields. And my dad read The Illustrated Man and fell in love with it. A great Ray Bradbury book. Second or no, let me think, his third book. It's a short story collection published in 1951. And my dad read it. And when my mother was pregnant with me, my dad would read aloud to my mom with me. I'm the youngest of four, but he would read aloud to her. And he decided to pick The Illustrated Man off his bookshelf and read those short stories. It begins with this story, The Veldt, which I know you guys are familiar with, this creepy vision of kind of a future nurse, virtual reality nursery for children. The children hence become addicted to the technology and the parents try to get them away from it. Very much a metaphor for our devices today. And so my dad read these stories, kind of weird stories to read to a pregnant woman, but you know, I don't know what happened, but I became his biographer. It's just completely uncanny.
You got it soaked in, right? So through the womb.
Yeah. Totally.
You've so been Ray, bred Ray since loved... before you were born to do this.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a story Ray Bradbury would write about a baby who's read to in utero and emerges into the world fully literate.
It's like a nerd version of the people that play their kids classical music and hoping they're going to be like a world class violinist or something.
Right, I'm going to elevate your IQ by playing you Brahms, you know? So I didn't listen to Brahms or Beethoven or I listened to Bradbury. So he did say that. He said, wow, that sounds like a Bradbury story.
Did he?
Point,
oh, wow.
To your point. So I was able to tell him that story, though, because I was writing at the time for the Chicago Tribune, and Ray was turning 80 that year, and he was born in Illinois. So it was a perfect time to profile him for a local paper. And they, at that point, a lot of newspapers had Sunday magazines. This was before the downfall of our beloved periodicals that very few people know about called newspapers. So I wrote this cover story on him for the Chicago Tribune magazine, and I flew to Los Angeles and interviewed him, and it was supposed to last an hour. And it lasted six. He ordered lunch. He kept saying, like, what you're saying is he was so outgoing and extroverted and friendly. And I stayed 6 hours. He ordered lunch and he just wanted me to stay. And his very reclusive, very private wife was sitting up on a different, it's kind of a split level rambling home in West Los Angeles. And even his wife came out. I had gotten there at 10:30 in the morning and she had this humongous glass of Merlot. She's drinking Merlot and she's carrying a book, the biography of Marcel Proust, written in French. She's drinking wine and reading a French version of Marcel Proust. And she says, I've listened to all the interviews over the years. I've heard all the bullshit. I've heard all the same questions asked of my husband, but this has been a remarkable interview. And then he said the same thing. And he said, when are you coming back? And I think a lot of that was Ray. I think if you guys had done this interview, he would have said the same thing. But I also caught him after he had had a stroke. He had had a stroke 6 months prior to my meeting him. And so I think there was fragility and a sense of his mortality, which was pervasive throughout all of his oeuvre, you know, is just to live forever, right? And so I caught him at a very delicate, fragile moment, and he continued to invite me out. And he said, bring your tape recorder, bring your notepad, continue to interview me. So I wrote about him for Playboy. I wrote about him for Publishers Weekly. And at that point, I thought, God, there's no biography of this man. Why is there no biography of Ray Bradbury? And he said, you know, because biography means you're dead. He said, you know, if you want to do a book about me, if that's what you're getting at, call me in 30 or 40 years. And he was 80 at the time, you know. But I stayed.
But what an optimist.
Yeah, completely. He, you know, for all we know, he's living on Mars right now. I stayed after him in a very gentle, respectful way. And 6 months later, he said, you know, I've changed my mind completely. I want you to write a book about me. So that's how that journey began. And it's been an honor, a huge responsibility. You know, it harkens the Peter Parker responsibility quote. It's been challenging and difficult. And there were times when it was not easy to work with him. You know, he was a sensitive guy. So it was a difficult thing to navigate, but I came out of it, you know, speaking at his funeral, and we loved each other to the end. But I also had to navigate that dichotomy of, can you love your and deeply respect your subject and write an objective book? And so that was a delicate balancing act that I took some hits for from people like, you know, he's a sycophant. How can he write a book about Ray Bradbury? It's like, well, who better to write a book about Ray Bradbury than someone who loves him? Because that's what the guy was all about. So,
and the proof is in the pudding, ultimately, correct? It's like, I think people kind of forget that, like, we also, you know, the folks that do this for serious, and I don't even count me in this. Brez, maybe Brez does like real journalism now, versus, you know, talking to people on podcasts. But back in the Ain't It Cool days, like I would kind of pride myself on you know, asking questions that acknowledge somebody's past. But I was always the person that was, that if they told, like, they asked me my opinion on the new thing, and I, if I didn't like it, or if they asked me an opinion on something they did in the past that I didn't like, my self-rule, the rule that I'd set was, I'm not going to volunteer shitty information to make them feel bad, but if they ask, I will be honest. Maybe today's a little bit different because it's something funny, and I wonder if you guys have actually noticed this, but like, now the goal is to get sponsored and to do the shill stuff, right? Everybody gets really excited. It's like, oh, my favorite guy that I watch on TikTok or Instagram, or my favorite lady who plays this video game, she just got sponsored and now she's selling this. That's a sign of success. But when I was coming up, like, any hint of being wooed by a movie studio or whatever was just like, caused the biggest outrage. You know what I mean? It's like, it's interesting how the dynamics change. So I don't know if that would necessarily ring true for a lot of media today, but you know, for a good chunk of us, like, it's, we not only do we have our own ethical standard, we also, know that what we have lasts beyond, is going to be like a lasting part of the record. Right. And you want to have that be as accurate as possible, you know?
This is a great time to interrupt this conversation with a message from the new KingCast sponsor, SpaceX. Everybody loves a trillionaire. Elon Musk, just the greatest guy. We're so grateful for his support.
Saving the world, actually, if you think about it. So.
Yeah, really, really, really a hero.
Bradbury wrote about Mars. He's taking us there, baby.
Anyway, let's put that out into the universe. Maybe SpaceX. We'll get a check in the mail. I don't know.
You know, I actually tweeted this, or X'd it, but I don't like using that because tweet is a much better verb. That was that was the worst rebranding. Sorry, Elon, in the history of media.
Sorry, Elon. No offense.
Well, there goes that sponsorship. Thanks, Sam.
But no. I will add on to this as a compliment to Elon Musk, is that I think Ray would deeply respect him in that Ray lived for seeing humanity getting back to the moon as a launch pad to get to Mars. And that's been, regardless of Musk's Dogian politics, that's been his mantra throughout, is that we get to the moon and then we get to Mars to protect the longevity of our species. And that was Ray Bradbury's entire ethos when it came to space exploration.
But not at the cost of humanity, though.
He would not have liked the
indifference to human suffering that Elon Musk
or or democracy for that matter. Yeah. Right.
You know,
now we have, like, motorbikes doing flips over the Washington, over the White House South lawn. So
maybe Ray would have supported.
Had posted a clip from Idiocracy, and it was President Camacho. I know shit, like, for a hot second, I was like, well, like, I mean, listen, it's bad, but it's not that bad. Oh, never mind.
I mean, maybe Ray would have supported Elon's self-exploration, a launch to the surface of the sun. We've never explored there.
Uh-huh.
Lots of things to discover. But you
know how Cy King feels about that, for sure.
I got a co-pilot for Elon. We could put in the rocket with him.
Did you share your own short stories with Ray?
I did, actually. You know, and some of the... He was so giving to all writers, as you said in the introduction. Like, anybody who would come to him, he would mentor and give them critical feedback. It's really remarkable. You know, there was a story he told me in the mid-70s, a young writer came up to him at the Santa Barbara Book Fair and said, I have a title for a novel. It's called Raise the Titanic. And Ray said, don't tell anybody, don't say anything more, just go write it. And we all know that that became Clive Cussler, right? I mean, so Ray was giving to so many people. So I did read my stories to him. In fact, some of the stories that are in Dark Black, my short story collection, I wrote in his house. I just wanted to see, like, is there any magical dust floating about this home that this guy lived in for 50 years, over 50 years? So when he would take afternoon naps every single day, he did that his whole life. He always took a nap because he was a morning writer, and he felt that with an afternoon nap, he had two mornings to wake up and write twice. Oh. So when he would take that nap, I would go to this side room and write. And so I just, there's two stories in Dark Black, one about a group of kids who contact their deceased friend using a Ouija board. And another one about a little girl who gets lost in the 1950s in a forest, and her parents are forced, after a long search party, they're forced to leave, and just they've lost their child forever. And her ghost ends up wandering the woods seeking the love she never had because she was abandoned. And I wrote that in his house, and I read those stories to him. And he would sit in his leather, he had this Pottery Barn oversized chair, and he'd say, my God, you've written a Bradbury story. You've written a Bradbury story. So there really was no higher honor than hearing that.
Do you feel like that there's something a little extra, there's some zhuzh in there that isn't there when you write at your own house?
You know, the zhuzh, that's a great word. The zhuzh was, I think I had a proclivity to try to write more purple when I was in his house, like a little bit more flowery, a little bit more metaphorically, a little bit more Bradburyan. And that's very dangerous. Ray could get away with that. I don't think I can. So I like those two stories. I'm proud of them, but I had to tone down the descriptive, the exposition in those stories a little bit because I was feeling the zhuzh.
Yeah.
One, you know, I always think, I mentioned at the beginning, you know, here we are at the dawn of summer, and I always think of Ray's Dandelion Wine as the idyllic summer story. But you have a very short, very beautiful one in Dark Black. I mentioned the books mainly, it's a lot of like scary stories, eerie stories, gothic stories, but you have one called All the Summer Before Us, a very brief story about friends on a rooftop and summer stars. I think that captures some of that same spirit. Was that influenced by Ray as well?
Very much so. And that's, you know, Ray, I think what a lot of people don't realize, and I'd be curious what you guys have to say in relation to Stephen King and his body of work. A lot of people don't realize that I would say at least 75% of everything Ray Bradbury wrote, whether it was set on Mars or in a dystopian world where books are burned, or it was set in a small Midwestern town, 75 to 80% of everything he wrote came from a place of autobiography. And I'm not a King scholar like the two of you are, and I'm curious how much King, because so much takes place in Maine, right? In King's body of work, but so much
now Florida.
And now Florida, yeah.
If you needed any further proof that you're onto something there, it's like whenever he moved to Florida, suddenly all these Florida man stories started coming out. And they all have very different feels, by the way. The feeling of his Florida work is pretty drastically different from the Maine stories. So like I think that 75% might be maybe even a low guess on how much, you know, King puts into his own stuff. I mean, we already know that he, you know, his dad abandoned the family, and most of his male father protagonists feel like they're either trying to fill the void of what he wanted from his dad, or a reflection of the fears that he was doing the same shit his dad was doing. You know,
well,
he was
going to hurt the family.
Yeah.
Look at Pet Sematary. It starts by saying Lewis Creed never knew his father and was always looking for one. And then he met Judd Crandall, you know?
Yeah. And how 90% of his white male protagonists are authors of some form, you know, working their way through their stuff. I mean,
you can also see, like, Uncle Steve's been hooked on his iPhone, and he writes a story like Mr. Harrigan's phone, you know?
He's been checking his stocks too often, and he's like, I gotta write about this.
He gets a new word processor, and the word processor of the gods comes out. Like, right. In some ways, every author is like singing what he sees, you know?
I think that's totally true. And so to your question that started this was that little vignette that I wrote was absolutely true. When I was a kid, there was an old concrete factory outside of the town I grew up in. I grew up, and this is something Ray loved and found in common with me, I grew up in rural Illinois as well, and also Los Angeles for a time. But we would crawl up on the roof of this cement factory and just kind of have the philosophical conversations that 14, 15-year-old kids would have about the universe and life and death. You know, we'd sneak up a hibachi grill on the top of this thing and grill burgers. We got chased by the police once, but that little vignette is actually 100% true. And so to your point, I'm lowballing Bradbury's 75%. I think if I'm to be really honest, I think it's more 85 to 90%. People could say, well, how is Fahrenheit 451 Ray Bradbury's life? But he was very candid that Clarice McClellan, the young woman in Fahrenheit, is actually him. This book lover, this lover of life, who celebrates the power and majesty of the written word and turns to a fireman whose job it is to burn books and convinces him to take one home. Ray frequently said, Clarice is me. So even a book that is set in the future, that is deemed science fiction, is culled from his love of libraries, his love of books, and the monologues of those characters are pure Bradburyan monologues. As I was telling Anthony before we started recording, I heard Ray give these monologues frequently in the most sort of mundane settings where he would just give these monologues, observations on life. And I'm like, this sounds like it's straight out of Dandelion Wine, but the guy's eating a hamburger and just talking. You know, mind blowing. If I could give you an example, I asked him once, we were at the Four Seasons in LA, and I asked him, I said, what was your first encounter with radio? Because, you know, it was a medium in its infancy, as was film. And all he was, Bradbury grew with these different advents of media. And he said, you know, the first encounter with radio happened, I was out on the front porch of my grandparents' house in Waukegan, Illinois in 1925. His memory was photographic and perfect. And he said, I was lying on my grandfather's wooden porch, the planked wooden porch, and it was nighttime, and my father and my grandfather were smoking cigars, and I had my ear to the planks of the porch, and I could hear the baritone of my grandfather's voice coming through the xylophone of floorboards. And I'm like, He calls it the xylophone of, and then he took a bite of his hamburger, you know, and it's like, this is the way the guy talked. It wasn't just the way he wrote.
Oh, that's incredible. I had the pleasure of meeting him once, and I saw him speak once, and I had the same like reaction to that, like, because he was on a panel. I went to Dragon Con in 98 in Atlanta. And I was part of that Ain't It Cool News crew, like it was just starting up. And
I loved that, by the way. Ain't It Cool News was just a touchstone for me, honestly.
For all the warts and all of that site. Yeah, no, I'm still very proud of the stuff that I did, because I used it as a way to like teach myself to write, to watch movies, to dig into cinema. And I was learning on the go as I was going, because I started in high school. And I follow Harry Knowles, who started the site, was on a panel with Ray Bradbury, Ray Harryhausen, and Harlan Ellison. And he was set to moderate it. And the stories that they were telling were all about going to see King Kong for the first time in 33 and how that changed everything for them. And, you know, and how they all became friends later. And, you know, Ray Harryhausen didn't work on Kong. I think he came in for Son of Kong, maybe. But Willis O'Brien did the stop motion there. But they were talking about, you know, in that same detail you were talking about, like walking into the movie theater in 1933. And I couldn't believe it, you know, that like, I can't remember what I did 2 weeks ago, you know?
You know, and I often questioned whether that was just Ray using his imagination to remember and whether it was false memory. But then as a journalist, as I went back and started to authenticate or fact check his stories, the vast majority of them checked out. So it was eerie. So I mean, I think he had a photographic memory, and Willis O'Brien, That was his name, correct? On King Kong, was a mentor to Ray Harryhausen.
Yep.
So all those guys were interconnected. It's unbelievable.
Now, we always like to ask our guests about their Stephen King origin story. We got your Ray Bradbury origin story. When did you first become aware of King? And it could be anything. Just like it could be a VHS copy at the rental store that just caught your eye, or his American Express commercial. But when did you first clock Stephen King?
Wow, that's a great question. It would have been Salem's Lot on television. So what year would that have been?
79.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and it creeped the absolute hell out of me. And he was on my radar screen. And I found Stand By Me to be incredibly Bradburyan, very much like a Dandelion Wine kind of story. Rural, boyhood, coming of age. So I started to deeply connect with him. So I connected with him first through film, which then drew me to the books. I don't know whether you guys, it was the reverse order or not, but I discovered him filmically, cinematically. But then as the years went on, I mean, and I read his work, I would say, you know, you guys asked me, what are your favorites? I mean, I love Different Seasons just because Shawshank Redemption, I rank up there as most likely my all-time favorite film. Yeah. And I love its source material deeply. But then The Body is in there, which became Stand By Me, and two other stories. I think not enough people talk about novellas. And I think just as Bradbury, to me, is the master of the short story in the genre of fantasy, science fiction, and horror, Stephen King is the master of the novella. Personally, I don't think there's anybody who does that format better. And so when I was putting together the book that you held up, Shadow Show, of course I wanted Stephen King to write a story in honor of Ray. And I spoke with his longtime assistant several times. She said, I'll deliver the message. His son, Joe Hill, had already agreed to contribute a story. And I wrote Stephen King several times, talked to his assistant several times, and just never got an answer. So I never did this with Ray ever. I asked him, could you do me a favor and write a letter to Stephen King and ask him if he'd be willing to contribute to this anthology? And Ray said, absolutely. Let's work on it together. So I dictated it a little bit and he changed things. And he had his assistant, who was his youngest daughter, send it to Stephen and got a response back instantaneously from Stephen King. So I'm like, oh, we're getting close to having Stephen King in this book. And I was stunned at the response. And so, and I am going to be very candid here. He said, Ray, so good to hear from you. Welcome to the rarefied realm of the nonogenarians, meaning Ray had just turned 90.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't have anything in this old Yankee cupboard as of this moment, but if anything shall restock it, I'll be sure to give it to you. Yeah. So it was kind of like this, I don't know, I guess that's a no. You guys tell me.
Yeah.
That's there's nothing easy right here. But King is that way too, and I've noticed that as well. Like when we made our first ask to get him on the show, we had a friend, Charles Ardai, who's the head of Hard Case Crime, and I've gone back to the Ain't It Cool days, and I didn't realize that he was married to Naomi Novik, who wrote a great fantasy series that I actually talked a lot about on Ain't It Cool, and. But anyway, we go back to those days, and I was just like, listen, I know everybody and their mother wants to try to get, you know, a little piece of Stephen King, but, you know, hopefully we've established ourselves at this point. We've had some really cool guests on, and, you know, we can, you know, maybe we can at least plant a bug in his ear. And I did the same thing where, like, we crafted the email, like, paragraph by paragraph, and, like, don't make it too long, but don't make it too short either, and try to do all this stuff. And we, like, really sweated about it and sent it off to Charles, who forwarded it on. And I sent that, like, say at noon on a Thursday or something to him, and he's like, great, I'll forward it on, and great. And I went to go eat, and by the time I came back, there was a response, and King said he was in. And
oh my God. And it's a great interview, by the way. I've watched it. It's fantastic.
Well, and then it took 9 months after he said yes for his schedule to work out. And he kept kicking the can. I'm like, oh, no, this is going to be one of those things. But then he did it. And then
we
were lucky enough to get him back on, you know, when Brez came on as the official co-host. And he kind of christened the Breznican era of, you know, with the second chat. So no,
no minor way to begin your tenure on the podcast there, Anthony.
What's Joe Hill's story? Tell us about Joe Hill's contribution to Shadow Show.
So I know Owen through academic circles, and he's a very down-to-earth guy. And I'm a huge fan of 20th Century Ghosts.
Yeah.
Joe's collection of short stories. And had written him a letter or an email and said, would you be willing to submit something? He said, absolutely. And then as time went on and the deadline for the manuscript grew closer to give that to the publisher, which was William Morrow, Joe still hadn't turned his story in. And I was at the Stoker Awards in, I think it was 2010 or 2011, down at the bar. And there's Joe. And I said hello to him and offered to buy him a beer. And he said, basically, I know you're going to ask me about the stories, like, you know, I know I'm late, you know, I'm having trouble with it. I don't know. I'll do my best. And I was heartbroken because, again, I really wanted him in that book. He had told me his idea, which was basically the Lake Champlain monster, you know, a group of children who kind of a Loch Ness monster, but in Lake Champlain. And so he's stringing me along at the bar. He downs his beer and he said, so I'll get back to you. And I thought, oh, he's kicking me the can down the road now with this thing. And he had agreed. And then he turns around and he said, hey, Sam. I said, what? He goes, I'm just kidding you. The story's done.
Like, you fucker.
I was so fucking pissed off. But you don't tell Joe Mill you're fucking pissed off. And I love that story. I mean, he wrote a great story in that book. So he's a character, that guy, and he's a talent, you know, and he's made a name for himself, I think, completely outside of his dad.
Yeah.
So has Owen, you know. I think Owen's done so really fascinating.
I mean, the whole family, for that matter. I mean, it's remarkable. But all of this also led, and my love for Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption led me to becoming friends with Frank Darabont, who wrote the afterword to my collection of interviews with Ray Bradbury, Listen to the Echoes. It's in the hardcover. So Anthony and Eric, I need to get you this. This is the hardcover edition of this beast. Oh, I love that photo too of Ray.
That's a great photo.
I mean, we worked our butts off on this. Look at the end papers.
Oh my God, that's beautiful.
Nice.
We took color photos all through Ray's house. I'll send you guys copies of this.
Oh, I'd love to read it.
But Frank wrote the afterword to this book. And Frank and I kind of became really close because Frank was adapting Fahrenheit 451,
mm-hmm.
Writing the screenplay. This is prior to the Michael B. Jordan HBO adaptation in 2018. So in the early 2000s, Frank had secured the rights from Mel Gibson, of all people, and was working on a draft of Fahrenheit 451. And we would have dinner periodically. And Frank was just, you know, I think to properly adapt any author like this, they have to be in your DNA. And I'm writing an essay right now that I told you guys about by email called Why Do Most Adaptations of Ray Bradbury Books Suck? Because the truth is, you know, Frank Darabont told me one night over dinner, Ray has never been properly served on the screen.
No.
There's never been a great adaptation of Ray Bradbury. There's been good, but there's never been a sublime adaptation of a Bradbury book. Some would argue Disney's Something Wicked This Way Comes is very close. Some would argue Francois Truffaut's 66 adaptation of Fahrenheit is superb. And they're both good, but they're not perfect. So I think Darabont is correct. And then the lion's share of Bradbury adaptations are terrible. And it's because a lot of these people who wrote these scripts didn't have him seeped into their DNA. His language, his vernacular, his use of metaphor, his poetry of language. And Rod Serling, once said of Ray Bradbury that he's very difficult to adapt because that which sounds wonderful in the head is almost impossible to speak through the mouth. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like what Harrison Ford said to George Lucas. You guys recall that,
right? You can write this shit, George, and we have to
say
it.
You can't say it.
I think there's a similarity with what Bradbury writes. And Darabont wrote Fahrenheit 451, gave me a copy of it, and it's absolutely majestic. It's perfect. It's a perfect screenplay.
What did he get right in that screenplay? I know that the movie ended up never happening, but like, what was it to you that like when you read it and you're like, this would do justice to Bradbury in a way that nobody else has been able to do on the screen?
He nailed the emotional resonance of the book perfectly. All the emotional chords that Bradbury strikes and intellectual prescient chords that Bradbury strikes in terms of predicting where society will continue to unravel. Darabont hit those perfectly, but with nuance, not clubbing us over the head. He allowed Bradbury to... Bradbury once said, how are you going to write your biography, Sam? And I said, well, I'm going to do all my research and then I'll have it by me and I'll start writing. And he said, that's the way to do it. Do it like osmosis. Absorb everything and then put it all aside and just write. And you can go fact check everything later. And I think Darabont absorbed Fahrenheit 451 so intuitively, so spiritually, that he was able to sit down and conjure it almost like a seance on the page. The fidelity it has to the book is very important. It's very, very true to the book. No gratuitous changes, you know, and I think there's similarities with Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption and Darabont's Shawshank Redemption. There's a lot of faithfulness to the source material. He had to add things. He changed some things. We know that. But what he changed added to it in the spirit of the author, because the author is in Darabont's bloodstream. Right. The author, Bradbury, was also in Darabont's bloodstream. And that came through in the script. It's a shame that movie was never made.
Yeah. That's true of a lot of filmmakers like Darabont, where you wish there was a little more. Always wish you could get another film out of him. I hope he does make something more. Are you still in touch with him?
Periodically. So he wrote this afterword. When Ray was still alive, Darabont said, hey, there's no American Masters documentary on Ray Bradbury. Do you want to work on this together? So we started to have meetings and took Ray out, and Ray was very excited. But then Ray realized he had given a documentary over to his son-in-law, his former son-in-law, who he loved dearly, who was putting together a documentary on his life. And Ray said, you know, I don't want to betray family. Mm. And he said, I love you, Sam. I love you, Frank. I think you guys would do a remarkable job, but I don't want to betray my former son-in-law, who was a great guy. I'm going to let him see what he does with this. The son-in-law subsequently passed away after Ray, so that film was never released.
Wow.
So I've gone back to Frank and said, hey, do you want to rekindle this? There's a lot of unreleased interview footage with Bradbury dating back to the 60s, early 60s. A lot of stuff out there that people have never seen. But that, when I went back to Frank, that's when he was going through his entire situation with A&E.
With AMC.
Yeah. And so I think he was taking a step back, and I don't want to push him, but I would like at one point to reunite, because I think the two of us have Bradbury in our DNA, obviously. And I'd like to do that film.
Yeah.
Bradbury kind of liked The Illustrated Man, didn't he, with Rod Steiger?
Well, that's a good question. You know, The Illustrated Man is a collection of short stories, and it surrounds the framework of a carnival performer whose body is covered in tattoos, and each tattoo is a story in the book, right? And they're all frightening, dystopic visions of the future. And when Bradbury sold the rights, the only thing he retained was casting approval. So he selected Rod Steiger because they were dear friends dating back to the mid-50s. But after that, Bradbury had nothing to do with that film. And the film focuses more on the frame story of the Illustrated Man than it does these individual anthology stories. I think that that film would have been a perfect anthology series, still would be today. An Illustrated Man anthology series would be fantastic. It didn't work so well. It was clunky. It was awkward. And so when Bradbury left the preview of that, a little boy ran up to him. This was 1969. A little boy who's a Bradbury fan said, "Mr. Bradbury, what happened? What happened to this film? What happened to your book?" And Ray said, "Beats me. I have no idea." So no, he loved Rod Steiger in it. He thought he was perfect, but he didn't like the script. Mm-hmm. I didn't like the choices they made. So
well, that little boy was Frank Darabont.
Well, you know, in I guess this opens up a question of what does make a good adaptation versus a bad one. And, you know, when in the world of King, we had essentially three titans that I consider as adapters. You had Frank Darabont, you have Mike Flanagan, and you had Rob Reiner. Right. And those three guys, for whatever reason, they were able to convey the feel of reading a Stephen King book with their adaptations. Not only made them good movies, but there's a feeling that you get reading King. Stand By Me and The Body, you know, is a perfect example of it. Shawshank Redemption is a perfect example. Green Mile is a perfect example of that. There's something that's intangible to me about a great adaptation that has to do completely with feels, and that's the hardest thing, because you can say, okay, Stand By Me has a lot of dialogue just ripped right from King because he's got the rural, you know, catchphrases, he's got the right phrasing from the 50s, you know, like this is all pulled from his life, the autobiography part of it. So there's one step, okay, we can get the authenticity of King's dialogue by just pulling it out, but there's has to be more to it than that. So what do you think about those intangible and that the feeling of reading
that is such a profound question. And I think if we had the answer 100%, Hollywood would be hiring all of us right now to write everything, you know.
Right. But right.
I think you absolutely, Eric, just hit it on the head with this observation of feeling. It's one thing, you know, that old cliche is write what you know. Okay, that's kind of basic. How about writing what you feel?
Mm.
And that's a deeper, more difficult thing to achieve, to write what you feel, to exercise the emotions that live within your heart and put them down through your fingertips onto a keyboard or through a pen onto a paper is a very elusive, magical process. And so for an adapter to take the original emotions of a creator and to feel those same emotions and translate them to a script, then onto a screen, is an incredibly difficult and elusive process and mystical. And so I think you need masters of craft, and you just named the three you named are, I think, and, you know, God rest Rob Reiner, who, in my opinion, I mean, his filmography is unbelievably exceptional. But so you have masters of craft who understand how to bridge not just what they're reading on the page, but the feeling that's on the page and translate that into a screenplay. That's a mystical process. And I think it takes, again, understanding that writer so well, the source author so well, that, like Ray said, it's almost through osmosis. You are channeling their ghost into the screenplay.
Right. Because it's not just with an author, you know, not to say, oh, it's so easy to be a great author. It absolutely isn't. There's a trillion books rotting off, you know, ignored out there for good reason. But, you know, for an author to convey that feel, they need to master their singular craft of writing. But for a filmmaker to adapt it, that feeling has to come through their camera movements. It has to come through the script, the writers they hire, whether William Goldman or one of these other, you know, masters, the score, the cinematography, like all those. If one of those slats in the picket fence is broken, you notice it, right? And so there's like a thousand things that go into a feeling in a film versus, you know, essentially one major thing in a novel, correct? So
And there's this whole issue of like, what do you cut and what, in the case of a novella or a when you're adapting a short story, what do you have to add? And how do you keep the same emotional resonance over to what you're adding to a story? And so, you know, if we were to just survey people who have seen Shawshank Redemption, and, you know, we know millions of people have because it reruns constantly. Mm-hmm. Arguably the most iconic scene in the film, in my opinion, you guys might disagree, and please do, but to me, the most iconic scene in the film is not in the story. And it's the prison yard and the Mozart playing out to all the prisoners, mm-hmm. and then down into the license plate factory.
Right.
And it's when Andy pulls the vinyl record out of the library collection and puts it on and locks the doors and blasts it out to give hope, yeah. to all of the inmates. That's a beautiful mm-hmm. scene, and it's not in the story, but I'd be curious to know how Stephen King felt about that. Mm. Maybe you guys asked him that.
No, not that directly.
Because that's
we'll throw it on the list if we can ever talk him into coming back. But
it seems like he does appreciate changes. Like, he kind of liked the change to the Pet Sematary remake where they switched which kid died. He said he liked just seeing the variation and the variety. And what was Edgar Wright told us about The Running Man that Steve told him? It's faithful enough that I'm happy, and it's different enough that I'm interested.
Right.
You know?
Well, yeah, and famously, he told Darabont that if he had thought of his ending for The Mist, he would have written it, you know? But I think that a lot of that goes into the theme and understanding the theme and what's going on under the surface of these stories, right? Because the scene that you talked about in Shawshank, you know, that whole thing really is about Andy and Red as good friends. Red doesn't have the hope, and Andy doesn't lose the hope, right? And go, even though they don't sit there and have, like, you know, conversations directly talking about him, one of the last lines, I believe, of the novella is Red on the bus going to Zihuatanejo, right? And going, right. I hope I see my friend.
I think that's the last line, yeah. I hope.
Yeah.
So there's your character arc.
Right.
But I don't think in the story it is ever said, because in the movie, Red cautions Andy, stating that's a very dangerous thing. Hope is a very dangerous thing to have in here. And I don't think that's in the novella. Maybe it is, but I don't recall it being there. But the last line definitely ends on the theme of hope. So I think Darabont made some very subtle, it's almost like you're mending a very delicate, very rare blanket, and you have to thread through very delicately. And I think these directors you named, this triumvirate, these three directors, all have this ability to thread into an already existing masterwork, which is incredibly daunting. And so I don't think it's really ever been properly done for Bradbury, because he hasn't had the right people on the job. I mean, one could argue that, well, Francois Truffaut is undeniably a master, right? Mm-hmm. But he was also one of the progenitors of the auteur theory in cinema, and put his stamp all over that movie by casting Julie Christie in two roles. You know, it's just all over. It's very French, even though it was Truffaut's first English language film. And it's good, and it's cool, and it's got this really wicked mid-century sleekness to it. It's a very good movie, but it's also not the book.
The Shining for King, right? It's that Kubrick is front and foremost, and that might be one of the reasons why King is such a visceral negative reaction to it, right?
And Kubrick was an auteur director, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's... There must be luck involved of aligning the right director with the right project. And then there has to be, Ray always said to me throughout all 12 years of our relationship, and this is such a cliche, but it's so true. The most important thing in the world is love. He said, you have to love what you do and do what you love. He always said that. Love what you do and do what you love. And he said, let me give you an example of this. He said, as a boy, I loved dinosaurs. And that led me to King Kong and other monster movies. And he said, I took my love of dinosaurs when I was 31 and wrote a short story called The Foghorn about the last dinosaur, a plesiosaur ostensibly, lumbering from the depths of the cold water and two lighthouse keepers looking down and seeing this craning neck rise out of the water, you know, seaweed dripping off it and water. And the lighthouse keepers are looking down at this, the last dinosaur on Earth, hearing the cry of this tower, this sad moan of the foghorn, thinking perhaps this is the call of its mate. It's a metaphor for unrequited love. And Ray told me, can you imagine if I didn't stay in love with dinosaurs when I got older? He said this whole thing of, oh, grow up, that's kid stuff, is bullshit. Stay in love with all the things you loved as a child and revisit them as an adult. That's what you guys do every episode of your podcast, right? Yeah. Is you're revisiting things you love.
Arrested Development has been approved by none other than Ray Bradbury.
Tell that to our families.
Was Ray, I imagine Ray was a big reader. Did he read any Stephen King that you're aware of? Did you guys ever talk about his feelings about King?
He had great admiration for Stephen King, but Ray stayed away. I know he read, he picked up a couple of the earlier works, Shining, Salem's Lot. I think he would have liked some of his later work, but Ray never read. He had a rule. He never read genre fiction after about 1950. There's a couple different reasons for that. He always maintained that he didn't want to subconsciously borrow from his peers. So he said, if I start reading a lot of Stephen King, I'm going to start writing Stephen King ideas. And so Stephen King would get his books to Ray Bradbury. He gave me a quote that's beautiful for the Bradbury Chronicles. Stephen King said, without Ray Bradbury, there is no Stephen King. I mean, that's an incredible statement, right? And so he loved Bradbury and would send him his books. And Bradbury read at least parts of The Shining, parts of Salem's Lot. But I think he had a rule for himself that he would stay away from genre fiction because he didn't want to subconsciously steal from it. But I also think Bradbury became a fantasist. He didn't classify himself as a science fiction writer or a horror writer. He classified himself, if he had to have a label, as a fantasist. And he said that he learned from Hemingway, Eudora Welty, Willa Cather, John Steinbeck, F. Scott Fitzgerald. He read literary writers and took what he learned from them and brought it over to genre fiction. So he didn't read a lot of Stephen King, which I would probably break Mr. King's heart. But I think it was because Bradbury didn't want to rip him off. But he did visit some of them, and I know he read King's On Writing. And because a lot of people can think that the two best books on writing, or perhaps the three, and you guys, we can have a cage match on this. Stephen King's On Writing, Ray Bradbury's Zen and the Art of Writing, and possibly Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird. Those are the three I would put up there. I don't know where, if you guys were going to name this.
I've not read Anne Lamott's book, so fantastic. Can't say.
Fantastic.
Well, it's interesting though, because you talk about not to completely shift gears, but you talk about, you know, the impact that Bradbury had on King. I think I read a quote that he had when he passed, and he was talking about the sound that you hear is the, you know, the thunder fading or whatever, the footsteps of a giant. Or I'm completely butchering it. There's a reason why he's Stephen King, and I'm not.
You're getting it actually.
But he had, you know, he had a reverence for it. But then, like, it also strikes me, like, there's a story that he wrote for Nightmares and Dreamscapes called The House on Maple Street, which is, it's more of a nod to Richard Matheson, but it's, if my memory's correct in this, like, he names the family. They're the Bradbury family.
He does. Yeah, right? He does.
And,
yeah.
And, like, you can tell, I mean, in this whole Pulp Fiction thing, and I love that, you know, that King grew up reading Bradbury and obsessing over that stuff, who was writing about stuff that he was obsessed with, you know, these dinosaurs, the monsters, and you know, all the Pulp Fiction that he would read, you know, when he was a kid. And I love this kind of pay it forward attitude in cinema. You can see that with Steven Spielberg, right? Steven Spielberg grew up on the 50s sci-fi stuff, and he, you know, now people are copying and moving that kind of fantasy storytelling forward, right? And there's something about that Russian dolling of
wow,
you know, that I just love, and I and to me that that's where the real legacy is going to be, right?
Oh my gosh.
I mean, Bradbury's legacy, you know, is unquestionable at this point, and I feel like King's legacy is going to be very much the same.
I love the nesting doll metaphor. Ray would love that. And
good.
You're right. I mean, I happened, Anthony and I had lunch several years back at the Pacific Dining Car because Ray loved the Pacific Dining Car. It was an old school steakhouse in Los Angeles.
And right.
We went in there, Ray and I went in there once, and Steven Spielberg was there and joined us. And you know, so we're sitting here with Steven Spielberg all of a sudden. And Spielberg told Bradbury on numerous occasions that Close Encounters was, he basically said, that's your film, Ray. And Ray said, what do you mean? He said, well, when I was a little boy, I saw It Came from Outer Space and became enamored with the UFO phenomenon and science fiction. And he said, because of that love, here we go back to love again, he wrote Close Encounters. And now this week we have another Spielberg UAP, UFO, Disclosure Day. And so you're right. It's this nesting doll effect. And who will Spielberg then, who will be the nesting doll for comes out of Spielberg? It's remarkable.
Oh, it's going to be beautiful.
And that, so, and that, that comes down to Ray's whole ethos of, I want to find a way to live forever. And you're speaking directly to it.
To
it. Is this immortality through art.
We talked a little bit about adaptations and how Ray never got his. I was born in 81, so I was a child of the 80s. I was the perfect age for something wicked, right? And I love the spooky stuff.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I can see where, you know, the adaptation doesn't,
it isn't its
full best, but I think that also, to me, that's the one that when I say I get a feeling watching that I think the tone of that echoes a lot of the feeling I got when I read the story. You know, we've talked about that one, but can you talk, like, who would you think, outside of Darabont, or maybe Darabont's the only one, who do you think has the sensibilities to bring a Bradbury story to the screen?
Oh, wow.
Obviously, a thousand things have to go into it, but, like, if you had to look at kind of the kind of films that are out, like, are there any that you go, that filmmaker would intrinsically kind of understand?
Why? I mean, you know, Spielberg is getting up there in years, but I think Spielberg's in his bloodstream. He's in his DNA. Bradbury's in his DNA. So I think he could still capture that magic in a bottle. In terms of younger directors, you know, everybody's going to name a Christopher Nolan. I don't know, perhaps. Rob Reiner, I think, could have done an amazing job because I think Ray Bradbury is a humanist. Before he's anything else, he's a humanist.
Right.
The human condition exudes out of every single story he wrote. And I think Rob Reiner was a humanist. And so, you know, God rest his soul. It's tragic what occurred. I think he could have done a fabulous job.
Right.
That's a really vexing question. I'd be curious to bounce it back to you guys. Who do you think could nail that?
You know, I think it's not as quite as legendary a name as like a Spielberg or a Darabont, but there's a director named Jake Schreier who did Thunderbolts. And I think he did a John Green adaptation. Is it Paper Towns, a John Green book?
Right.
Yeah.
I think
He did a film, I think one of his earliest films from maybe the early 2010s was called Robot and Frank. And it had Frank Langella as like an old man in a nursing home who gets state of the art robot assistant who looks like the little Honda robot, you know? And to me, that's like a Ray Bradbury short story, is a guy whose memory is fading, who resents who has basically no future, is confronted with the future, and the future is sort of capturing what he cares about and what he believes and becomes his friend. And then when he's gone, kind of is the only thing that will remember him. You know, I think that's a very Ray Bradbury story, right? Is this resistance to AI, and then AI is the only thing that remembers you were ever here.
Right. You know,
So I would say Jake Schreier has, like, again, the kind of heart that it takes to tell that sort of story.
Eric, that's a great example. Eric, did you have a
No, I don't have a good name. I mean, the Spielberg thing is really the only thing that makes sense to me, because you even like the response to Disclosure Day that I've seen is what people are kind of reacting negatively towards is that humanity, that pure belief in humanity and them doing the right thing. I don't know if I completely buy what happens in Disclosure Day, but I think COVID is in the COVID era, like, really made me super cynical about humanity and their ability to, you know, kind of not be shitheads to each other at every
possible
turn. That's
the key word. Cynicism is that I don't think Ray Bradbury was a cynic. He was a total optimist. He was very earnest, and you need a filmmaker who's willing. I think Darabont has this, like, although whenever he's veered into earnestness, people tend not to like it. What was that film he did with Jim Carrey, The Majestic, that was very, very sort of 1950s hopeful. I think hope and optimism can rub people the wrong way. And,
I'm not sure if Frank is that hopeful and optimistic.
Maybe not anymore. You know,
I
think, like, he can capture that.
You also need somebody that has the technical ability to really make you connect to the characters, you know, which is, it sounds like that should be a given with any filmmaker, but, like, that just sadly isn't, you know, that's just not on the, you know, the forefront of most people, what they care about. I think we're way more plot driven now than emotion, you're driven by emotional connection. So,
how about the Duffer Brothers? Could you see them doing, like, I could see them doing a take on I Sing the Body Electric with this robotic grandma,
I would like to see them take a collection or do like a Ray Bradbury theater reboot and do an anthology series. I mean, I can
speak. The Illustrated Man, baby.
Exactly. I can speak from what Ray would say, you know, what he told me when he was alive. So these two directors are a bit dated because Bradbury passed away and 2012, but he sent, after seeing the King Kong remake, and as you mentioned earlier in this episode, how much King Kong imprinted him and Harryhausen and Forry Ackerman and so on, he was so enamored by Peter Jackson's King Kong that he sent him the Martian Chronicles and said, I'll give you the rights for free. Wow. Please make this book. He wanted Peter Jackson to make the Martian Chronicles. And that said, and I'd be curious, this might be controversial, after seeing Dances with Wolves and some of Kevin Costner's baseball films, he sent Dandelion Wine to Kevin Costner and said, I'll give you Dandelion Wine free of charge if you'll make this movie. I won't charge you a penny. And to Ray's heartbreak, neither director got back to him. I don't know. It's very possible they never received the books. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's interesting. I know Peter a little bit. And Peter's like the opposite of Ray, where he's very insulated, and he keeps a pretty tight circle, you know, around him. I think Spielberg's a little bit the same way now, and just kind of out of necessity, I guess. But
Guillermo del Toro, what do you think?
Guillermo. That's really interesting, because Guillermo does move. His sensibilities always kind of go to the macabre, but. He has the exact same origin that love of King Kong, that love of the monster, that feeling, the empathy, you know, his stuff, Shape of Water, is very much, yes, humanity sucks, but there's beauty in everything sucking. It's not exactly a one-to-one, but yet he can connect. That's that human connection. You need that thing that can somehow doesn't come off as cheesy and, you know, nostalgic, but also has that love and reverence and that awe. So it's funny how we keep talking about all these filmmakers who go down, you know, the core of all these filmmakers is that character, that humanity, that hope in humanity somewhere. You know, sometimes the hope is small. You know, nobody's going to look at Shawshank and go, that's every second of that's a feel good movie, you know, but people do remember the end of that movie, right? And that feeling as you witness what happened, you know, to Andy in his escape, and that thrill you get when he does it. Like, there's a feeling that you can get, and going back to that intangible, there's a feeling that these filmmakers that we were talking about can give. And it sounds like, you know, what the argument is that as good as Bradbury as good as a lot of the movies that are based on Bradbury stuff are, they don't have that right feel.
And it's just, how do you contend with such lyrical prose? Not every character can speak like they're a romantic right. poet. And Ray's exposition is incredibly lyrical. And how do you get that lyrical quality into, I guess, the mise-en-scene, what's on screen, you know? I think that's been the challenge. You named Something Wicked This Way Comes, and I think the majority of Bradbury fans deem that as the closest adaptation. And there's one of the primary reasons for that, that it's named as the best adaptation, not perfect, but the best, is that Ray Bradbury, that's the only script of all of his adaptations that right. he wrote himself.
That's right.
Mm. He wrote that. So the human condition that you're talking about is allowed to come through because the source author of the source material wrote the screenplay. And also, I think Jonathan Pryce as Mr. Dark is unbelievably well cast. And
Jason Robards as the father is
fantastic.
Know, tired old dad, you know.
Tired old dad. Yeah.
I think what I love about that story is that the guy is like, the father is like, oh, I'm an old dad at like 42, and I'm now like 8 years older than that. I'm like, wait a second, that's not so old. That's not so old. You bring up a good point. Maybe that's a good place to wrap things up here on the show is.
Sure.
We could talk and spin our wheels about what kind of movie should be made, but everybody who reads Ray Bradbury, just like everybody who reads Stephen King, they make their own movie in their head. And when I think of my favorite Ray stories, it is the language that I love the most, but also the feeling of his plots. He doesn't have heavily plotted books that rely on twists and turns so much. It's more of a sort of ironic feeling or a tragic feeling. It's funny, you mentioned Raise the Titanic earlier. And Sam, it's like we're on some weird wavelength. I just got back from a little family vacation. When I'm at the beach, I like to read spy novels, you know? And I have a paperback of Raise the Titanic that I read, which
it's
is a spy
book.
Novel. Well, yeah. It's a great story. And the book, I found the writing atrocious. Like, one of the worst
but it's
writers.
Like, it's like Dan Brown. I mean, we're not going to this for literary
expertise.
No, but
it's worse. It's so much worse. Like, it's like his writing. There's a character who's talking about, like, this scientific program, and they need this element that was being transported from... Right. Aboard the Titanic, and he's like, I need to manifest this idea. It is from the sperm of my mind. And I was like, this is the worst writing ever. But it's interesting you bring that up, because I think that I was telling my wife, like, that's an excellently plotted book. I love all the surprises and the twists right. and the turns of it, but the writing isn't good. But with Ray, it's like the writing is so good. When I think of, like, Kaleidoscope, that's the short story about astronauts who are on a space station. There's a disaster. They get sucked out into the void of space in orbit around Earth, and they're in their spacesuits, so they're alive, but they're, I think he describes them as wriggling like silverfish.
Yep.
Yeah. And like, you can't, there's no better way to put that on screen than the description of wriggling like silverfish. And you know, the poetry of that, one of them falls to Earth. And he wonders if his life will have any meaning. And the ending of the story is a little boy seeing a shooting star and making a wish, unaware that he's wishing on this guy as he burns up on reentry.
Yeah.
But or like There Will Come Soft Rains, which is about the house of the future, automated, all of these mechanisms, making breakfast, folding clothes, putting the kids, tucking them in at night. It's sort of a companion to The Veldt. But it's about this house that's operating, and the family has been incinerated by a nuclear blast. Only the home survives, and it's trying to figure out how to function in a world where there are no people. And, his language is so gorgeous. I think there's my favorite version of that is there's a record put out by Leonard Nimoy where he reads a couple of Ray short stories, and that's one of them. You can find it on YouTube. It's a gorgeous reading of it.
Spock,
but his language itself, like. I haven't read The Foghorn, but I'm going to go find that book.
Oh,
I wonder, is it in that big red collection that's behind you?
It is not. That, you know, the guy wrote so many stories that there was a book called The Stories of Ray Bradbury, which came out in around 1980, 100 of his best stories. And then this came out in 2003, and it's 100 more of his best stories. So he's got 200 best of. That, You know, it's unbelievable. He dedicated this book, this Big Red book, in part to me, which was, I mean, unbelievable. Mm. The Foghorn, I shouldn't say this, but I mean, you can find it online as a PDF. It's right. In the Golden Apples of the Sun, but I can send you a copy of it. It's,
go off,
it's,
find it.
It's a, it's absolutely beautiful, beautiful short story. So this has been a very heady, remarkable conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely. You guys are
what's
awesome.
The other one? There's another one about Picasso where a man finds,
oh my God,
finds Picasso drawing on the sand, the hard sand by the surf, and he realizes I can run back and get
story.
I can go back and get my camera, or I can just look at this. But if I go get my camera, it's going to be erased. And like
that, to me,
I know that was made into a film, but like, how do you make that into a film? It's just a beautiful vignette.
Oh my God, I just am writing this essay about Bradbury's filmic life, and that was a disaster, which we could get into and we won't, but it was originally a story called In a Season of Calm Weather.
That's,
and it's
right.
A very short story about a married couple in the south of France, and the man is obsessed with Pablo Picasso. It's his hero, and he hears that Picasso is in the south of France, and the sun is going down, and he goes down on the beach, and unbelievable, there is Pablo Picasso drawing in the sand, creating his masterwork in the sand. And he wants to go home, get a camera, tell his wife, go back to the motel and get them. But he knows, like you said, that if he leaves, the tide is rising and it's going to all be gone. So he has to stop and live in the moment. Every Bradbury story has this grand metaphor, this grand meaning to it. And this, it's almost very Zen Buddhist. It's like, you got to live in the moment. You can't worry about sharing it with anybody else. This is your moment. He retitled it The Picasso Summer. I like the original title better, In a Season of Calm Weather. It's just more subtle, but you can find it called The Picasso Summer. They made it into a movie produced, co-produced oddly enough by Bill Cosby. You want to talk about weird. And
that is a fact I did not know.
it was the great, and Bill Picasso
Cosby could have been the director we were looking for
completely. Everybody who has a Cosby sweater, that's how we begin.
They're eating it. Picasso's drawing with a stick from a pudding pop,
right? Yes.
That film turned out to be a disaster and was never released, but. Picasso was set to star as himself. He agreed to star as himself. But they gave it to a French director who threw Bradbury's script out and shot it on the fly. Did a extemporaneous avant-garde art film with no script. That's at least Bradbury's version of the story. And so it was never released. Barbara Streisand sang a song on the soundtrack. It does run occasionally on late night television on cable, and you can see it, but it's nonsensical and weird. Albert Finney stars in it. But again, it's this heartfelt, gorgeous, humanist Bradbury tale that has so often eluded him on the screen. And I think Stephen King, for many reasons that you guys could articulate, has been able to translate to the screen, be it the large screen or the small screen, with much more success.
Well, the stories exist. Ray wanted to live forever, and as long as his pages are out there, he does. Let's all make our own movie by reading a great Ray Bradbury short story and also a great Sam Weller short story with Dark Black. You've got a great collection here.
Thank you, fans
of Stephen King, you will definitely love this book. And Sam, thanks for being on the show with us today.
What a great pleasure. I'm a big fan of you guys, and great to reconnect with you, Anthony and Eric. So nice. Thank you guys very much.
The Kingcast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.